Hi, I'm Rob Grizz and I'm the producer of Australian Rock of Ages, and it's a pleasure to bring you another program in this series of 24 monthly programs that will feature the life and time stories of some of the people whose talent, skills and dedication have contributed to the development of Australian music, particularly through the 1960s and 1970s. In this program, we feature the story of Mick Hamilton. It's been said that the strength of Australian music was its pub scenes, particularly in the 70s and 80s. That, you know, I've read many times that Australian bands have gone overseas and have watched local artists struggle when things go wrong. When things are right, they're fine. Whereas the Aussie bands, when things go wrong, because they've played in pubs, they just cruise through.
That's true. In the 70s, when I went over to England, little things would go wrong. I mean, the amp would go off or a lead would break. The English guys would be calling for roadies, calling for crew. We just stick our head down, bum up, and, oh, it's a fuse. Stick a bit of cigarette foil, paper foil in it. Totally, you know, disastrous way to do things, but it works. And got you back on the road. Yeah, it's true. And that was the big thing in London in the 70s. Australians were always regarded as just almost superhuman in not necessarily their musical ability, just their ability to keep the show on the road.
Now, the live music scene in Australia has changed dramatically because the number of venues just aren't there now.
Nah.
You know, for all sorts of reasons, gentrification of areas, poker machines and things like that. Do you think that's played an impact on the degradation of Australian music, or do you think it's survived anyway?
It's hard to say because, I'm old and I don't like a lot of the music, which doesn't mean it's not good. It just means I don't understand it. And I think, oh, this is all a load of crap. But of course it's not. Some is. And there are a lot of venues. To be fair, there's lots of venues and lots of young bands working. They're just not getting paid.
That's a big difference, though.
And that is the difference. When I was young, I was working
a lot. You said three days' work, your father's weekly wage.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, we were being paid well. And they're just not. The kids just aren't being paid well now. And I don't know where it can go because, firstly, they go out and they work live gigs and they don't get paid well. In fact, sometimes it costs them to play.
Mm.
Then the avenue to success and wider acceptance is to make a record. So they make a record. That costs them more money and then they get any money back from that because of streaming.
Yeah.
So I don't see where the hell it can go. And it certainly hasn't helped the music industry. But although Melbourne is full of music, but nobody's making any money out of it. And I know that's, it sounds a bit mercenary, but if you don't make money, you can't sustain it.
Well, that's right.
You have to pay your rent.
Yes.
You have to feed your family.
Yes.
And, you know, people who talk about, entertainment music is, you know, for the masses, it should belong to everyone. They've got another job where they're paying their bills from, you know.
Plumbing should be for the masses, so why isn't that free? The contemporary music or popular music in particular has always been seen as outside the mainstream of arts, and yet it really is a critical part, and certainly in Australia, isn't it? I mean, both directly and all the indirect industries that are associated with it support a lot of people.
Absolutely. There's been studies done, and I can't think of the figures, but, you know, music in Australia is worth billions of dollars overall to lots of people. I mean, there's studios, there's producers, there's songwriters, there's performers, there's venues, there's...
manufacturers, repairers, transport.
Transport, take musicians off the... planes for a start, and your airlines are going to take a hit, really. I mean, every time I fly to work, there's always other musicians on the plane. I mean, on any reasonable sized plane, at any time, there'll be 10 or 12 musicians. So.
Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Radio. Do you ever get concerned for the fate of Australian music?
Well, yeah, I'm concerned for the fate of music in general.
Mm.
But Australian music, not more so, because for the very reason you cited before, Australians always seem to find a way to get around the problem. Whether we can get around this one, I don't know, but it's not going to be my problem. I'm too old to worry about it, quite frankly, you know. I mean, at the age of 69, I'm not about to embark on a new career, and I'm not, you know, I'll bitch and whinge about the fact that I can't earn any money out of selling records anymore, but I'm not likely to make any more, so it doesn't matter to me. But it's a huge, huge concern for someone who's 30, say, and has talent and has songs and has ability. What do they do? Where do they go? I don't know what the answer is. I mean, you could do the time-honored thing of touring, just hitting the road and touring, but there's nowhere to go from there. That used to be a road to travel to get to the point where you could sell records and really make some money. But you can't do that anymore. So all you can do by touring is stack up a base for more touring. I mean, I even read things about people like Elvis Costello, for instance, who says he's had to go back on the road. He can't earn a living by his recording career anymore.
Yeah.
Well, he probably earn a living, but it's not the living he's used to, someone of that stature.
Yeah.
He's resigned himself to going back on the road and not seeing his kids grow the way he expected to.
Indeed.
Yeah, so when it hits people like that, you know, it probably doesn't hit people like the Stones, and it probably doesn't hit people like, I don't know, Beyonce or
but they're the exceptions.
Yeah, that's right.
They aren't they? There's always exceptions. You mentioned before that there's, you know, we old generation, probably sounds like our parents, probably don't connect with the music of the day the way the younger people do. Mm. And we tend to enjoy the music that came with us. Mm. Yet you'd be in a prime position to be able to comment on the fact that there is an awful lot of people out there that really enjoy the music of the past. I mean, you've recently done some fairly interesting gigs, basically reviving the music of the 60s and 70s, and they love it.
Yeah, they do love it. The only problem is, as I see it, is that it's event-based now. To get people our age out in numbers, it has to be an event. It has to be something you can flog. You can't just do it by having you and I playing at the local pub.
Oh, no.
Which you used to be able to do.
Yes.
But you can't do that anymore. It's got to be an event. You've got to be able to say, this is all these guys who had a hit in the 60s, all on the one bill doing this. That'll work. Doug Parkinson said to me recently, when I was talking to him about doing some shows, he said, you know, Mick, it's come down to the only way I can work now and get a crowd is to do the Joe Cocker songbook. He said, I can't go out and do shows and reliably get enough work to live and get people in. He said, just doesn't work. He said, so after all these years, I go out and I do the Joe Cocker songbook and I fill the room.
Yeah, look, that I think that story is pretty much across the board. You know, I live next door to Glyn Mason, and he and Sam are fantastic songwriters, and they've written some excellent stuff. And they've got a good following out in the pubs, but the stuff that people most enjoy is reliving the Eagles and reliving, you know, Creedence Clearwater. It doesn't matter how good your music is, they want to relive the...
That's right. It's common. John Paul Young's a great example. John Paul Young comes to Melbourne and works John Paul Young at the Palms at Crown or something. Lukewarm reception. He comes down and does the Vander and Young songbook. It's packed.
Oh, packed.
Yeah. And that's sort of where it's at now. That's any way people love the music, absolutely. But it has to be
an event.
An event, yeah.
Yeah, which is no way to actually be able to...
Well, you can't build a career.
That's what I'm saying, It's almost, you know. Yeah. If you had a group of young people sitting in here listening to this and they wanted to be musicians, you know, they're desperate, they're going to be here, what would you say to them? What would be your advice as somebody who genuinely has been through it, good and bad?
Well, it's it's tempting to take the cheap shot and say, get a day job. But I honestly don't know. I couldn't in all conscience advise anyone now to do music as a career, because I can't see it. I just can't see, for all those reasons we discussed. You know, I can't see any prospect of, there's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, which there was when I was a kid. You know, that pot of gold was to be Elvis Presley or to be the next Stones. Okay, you knew you weren't going to be, but there were stops along the way, then you might make one of those, which I did, and which a lot of people did. But I can't see a pot of gold for them to aim at anymore. It's just not there. There's just no point at where you can say, yes, I've made it, and you're going to get a sustainable, livable income. Honestly, I just don't see it. I know that's a horrible, horrible pessimistic view to take, and something will come along. It always does. Something will come along that I haven't thought of and nobody's thought of yet, which will perhaps regenerate the whole thing. But at the moment, the old model's gone and there's no new model that's workable.
It's a fairly realistic summation of the situation. No matter how black it is, it's fairly real.
I mean, on another level, even worse level, songwriters, there is absolutely no system in place to recompense songwriters now. The artist gets this miserable 0.0008 per play. The songwriter gets nothing of that.
Nothing. Right.
Yeah, so where does a songwriter earn?
What's
the point of writing a song, using that your talent, putting a song together, getting someone to record it? There is no return at all, except the hard disk sales, which are a handful.
Yeah, and you go back to the days of Tin Pan Alley and the Brill Building and that people made a really good living.
Absolutely.
And really good music came out of it.
Yeah, of course.
It certainly has been a staged sort of regression, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
From that period.
Absolutely. And people say, you know, well, the songwriter can make money by taking the songs on the road. If they're successful, then people want to hear them. You go, not all songwriters are performers.
That's right.
In fact, lots aren't.
That's right.
Some of the best songwriters in history weren't performers.
That's right. Go back to Tin Pan Alley and the Real Building. That's right, exactly. We have quite rightly focused largely on you and your music and your perceptions of music, but you're also a person that lives on the planet, like all humans.
Yeah.
When you look around you, other than the world of music, what is it that concerns you, or what is it that gives you hope when you look around you?
Well, we get into the topic of the daily arguments on Facebook, etc., climate change. I mean, it's how anyone can deny that is just beyond me. It's just totally beyond me. I've been a believer and to a certain point an activist and an economic supporter of Greenpeace, etc., for decades. That's a huge concern. I honestly don't understand the logic of anyone who has an economic argument about dealing with climate change, because what on earth is the point of having a job and earning money if you don't have a planet to ply that trade on, which is very close to happening, you know? We're just shutting the place down. And it's, I don't know if it is reversible. It was.
Oh, so do you think it's a matter that people stick their head in the sand?
Yeah, well, some people do. I think some people willfully deny it, and I don't know why that is. In fact, I don't understand why, even if these people, I'll call them deniers for want of a better word, skeptics, I don't know, even if they're right, which I don't believe they are, but even if they're right, what can possibly be wrong with cleaning up the world? I mean, the worst that's going to happen is you're going to end up with a cleaner world. So I just don't get that for a start.
Do you think it's because it requires people to give things up? Like, for instance, you know, we all love our power.
Sure.
We all love our cars. We all love this, that, and the other. It might mean having to give things up in order to achieve those outcomes, and they don't want to do that?
Well, they don't want to do that, and I can understand that. I don't want to do that either. I mean, it's pretty hard for me to get on a train with an amplifier and two guitars to go to work. I'm not looking forward to that. but But the point is, when this all came to light and when this was all talked about first, that wasn't necessary, but it's becoming now that that will be necessary to, because we've let it go so long. And it's just, I don't understand it. I just find myself scratching my head and going, what is the point of protecting your economy if the planet goes to hell underneath your feet? Because the economy's not going to be worth much if you haven't got, you know, any power to power the factory that employs you. You know, it's just nuts.
When you look at the world on the other side of the coin, is there anything out there that you look at that gives you hope for the future?
Oh, I'd love to say yes, but yeah, maybe I read too many newspapers, but I find the outlook depressing. I mean, just looking at the terrorism aspect of things is a frightening concept. It hasn't stopped me doing anything. I still travel to places. You know, I never really travelled to places like Syria or Iraq anyway, so it hasn't affected my life directly, but it's certainly affected the way I think about things. And I just find that every morning I wake up and I'm almost looking to see what today's atrocity is. You know, I've almost reached that point. And that's distressing. It's awful to think that things have got that bad. And I honestly can't see how you stop something like ISIS. How do you deal with billion refugees? I just don't know how you do it. I mean, I'd love to say this is what you do. Well, how do you deal with all these people that are locked up on Nauru and Manus Island? I don't know. I don't know. If I had any clue, maybe I would have run for parliament. But I don't know. And I don't see, hate to be this person, but I don't see a way out, honestly. Because sometimes I feel, and my dad, when my dad was in his later years, he died at 89 or something, and he wasn't well in the last couple of years, and he was ready to go, and he basically said as much. And I used to say, ah, come on, Dad, you know, that'd be silly. I'm starting to understand him. I mean, I'm way younger than that, and I'm starting to think, man, I'm just about ready to leave this behind.
That's a really interesting comment, because when I started this job 14 years ago, I interviewed a number of older people who made comments like, I'd say to them, well, you know, how do you see the rest of your life? And they'd say, well, to be honest, I don't mind if it comes to an end tomorrow. I feel like I'm out of my time now.
Yeah, I can understand it.
You know, you and I are in our late 60s, which is fairly young now. Hitting us, we've got another 20-plus years left.
Yep.
It's not a very happy place to be in, is it, when you think it's all passed you by?
It's not. I mean, personally, my life is wonderful.
Inside.
I mean, I live comfortably. You're in my house now. I mean, it's comfortable. It's not a mansion, but it's everything I want. I'm happily married, a lovely wife who I love. I'm not working much anymore, but that's, you know, if I was in any sort of profession, I'd probably be retired by now anyway.
Exactly.
So, you know, and I'm not wanting for money. I'm not rich, but I'm not wanting for anything in particular. So my life personally is lovely. But the world I live in has just it's gone to hell. And, you know, sometimes I just think, I feel so helpless. I feel like I should do something and I can't. How long can I look at this without just becoming depressed and not dealing with it? It's like, is that existential depression, is it, I guess? I don't know.
It could also seriously be a realistic position, because would you agree that it's actually been said that one of the problems we face now is that we have such good communication. We know things are happening happen, whereas once upon a time, you know, 30, 40 years ago, it would take days, if not weeks, and even then the information would be fairly filtered. Yeah. But now you can turn your TV on and watch it happening.
Yeah.
Are we getting overloaded?
Probably, yeah, probably, and that's a lot to do with it. And, I mean, I read a newspaper every day, I watch a TV news each night. I have the radio on and hear news bulletins all day. I get on social media and see reports of stuff. I mean, probably way too much. It's probably my own fault. But the point is, it's still happening. It's even if I don't read about it and I don't.
That's right.
It's still there and it's still happening and it shouldn't be, and I don't know what to do about it.
Mick, I think that you're probably reflecting what a lot of people out there are thinking and feeling. And can we assume, though, that you still get some solace out of playing your guitar?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, as I said, my life personally, if you just put me in a little cocoon in this suburb where I live, it's wonderful.
Mm.
It is. It's wonderful. And I'm certainly not ruining or wishing for any more than I have. It's, and I just don't want to sound wanky, but it's on behalf of the people of the world that I get depressed, not my own behalf.
Mm. So for you, it's been a good life?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's been ups and downs like everyone.
Yeah.
You know, there's been times when I've thought, God, you know, this is horrible. How long can I deal with this? But you come out the other end and then it's good again. And then sometimes it's terrific. And the moment is terrific, really, except that aches and pains take longer to go away than they used to.
Yeah, we're beginning to all suffer that one. Mick, look, thank you very, very much for being on Listen to Older Voices. It's been delightful talking with you.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, I think a good place to finish would be with one of your tracks, and let's play Standing Too Close to the Flames, Mick Hamilton.
Now fools never learn, 'cause fools never try. I've been a fool long enough to ask myself why. I can't take a trick, but I stay in the game. I'm standing too close to the flames. Now the money that I spend, growing good after bad, just ain't worth the pain of all the heartaches that I've had. My friends say I'm crazy to mess with that thing, but I'm standing too close to the flame. Well, there's fire down below, but there's ice in her veins. She's letting me know that she's the one who holds the reins. I'm standing too close to the flame. She's not cruel to be kind, just kind to be cruel. She got love on her mind, and she's nobody's fool. And I know that it's wrong, and I know that it's a shame, but I'm standing too close to the flame. I'm
is a Handsome Doc production and is podcast through the Toorak Times and TAG.